It's a Wednesday edition of Locked On Heat. On today's show, we're joined by NBA writer Sarat Sohi to discuss her recent piece on Dwayne Wade's return to Miami.
And we'll talk about what the Toronto Raptors have to do in the playoffs to come out of the Eastern Conference. Thank you for listening, for subscribing. Now let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm a credentialed writer covering the NBA for the Step Back, and I write for the Miami Heat's Tip Off magazine. You can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg.
And I'm David Ramil, a credentialed NBA writer who's covered the Heat for SB Nation and AllYouCanEat.com. I cover the league at large for Fan Sided, and you can follow me and my writing on Twitter at DRamil13.
We'll be joined here in a minute with Sarat Sohi. She's a freelance writer based out of Toronto, and she's been published at ESPN, Bleacher Report, and writes a regular column over at SB Nation, and recently wrote a feature after talking with Dwayne Wade about his return to Miami.
We talked about her takeaways from spending some time with Wade and the Heat. She had some great quotes from Eric Spoelstra as well, and then we kind of jumped into some Eastern Conference playoff talk.
So here's our conversation with Sarat. NBA writer Sarat Sohi is in the house with us today. She recently wrote a piece about Dwayne Wade's return to Miami for SB Nation titled, "I'm Not For Everyone, I'm For Miami." And Sarat, I won't even make it past the headline before I ask you our first question, because I want to talk about that quote. You asked Dwayne what Spoelstra means when he often says, quote, "We're not for everyone." And then Wade said, "It's not for everyone is about I'm not for everyone. I'm for Miami. I might not be for everyone in Chicago or Cleveland." What is it about D. Wade that wasn't for those cities?
I think a multitude of things, really. In Chicago, there wasn't much of a winning culture in that locker room, even predating Wade's arrival. There was a lot of turmoil. The three alphas thing really, really didn't get going, and I don't think any of the young players really took to any of the vets on that team. If you guys recall, there were a couple of blow-ups in that locker room. The first one was Jimmy Butler, I think probably around January. I don't exactly remember now. And Butler was also somebody who was prone to calling out his teammates in public. And then later on in a game against Atlanta, they had a pretty bad loss. They blew, I think, like an 11-point lead in the last few minutes. And Wade kind of chastised his teammates for not wanting it enough, and then Butler chimed in, and then Rondo took to Instagram. I don't know why we're relitigating one of the most mediocre seasons in Chicago Bulls history right now, but suffice it to say that things didn't really take. And I think Butler and Wade are very similar in that they're both kind of nose to the grindstone guys that do believe that generally if you try hard enough that all the other issues can be glossed over. And Wade, having come from Miami, I don't think he was really ready to lead teammates that had a softer approach than what they do in Miami. And not to say that there's anything wrong with any of the guys in Chicago. It's just different.
And did he kind of go into Cleveland a little bit, or not really touch on that?
Not as much, with Cleveland, I tried to get into it, but every time I asked him specifics, he kind of went back to like how happy he was to be in Miami. I asked him if he calculated the idea of getting the playing time versus championship aspirations, and if he looked at Cleveland's roster and he said, okay, I'm not going to be able to play here. And it didn't really even go that deep. It was more so like, okay, like it's time to go back home.
Speaking of home, obviously you have an interesting quote from Udonis Haslem about how family works things out regarding the relationship that was strained between Pat Riley and Dwayne Wade. And he says that he figured that they would work it out. Do you get a sense from Wade that he actually does buy into this idea that Miami is a family? I mean, for him, he grew up here. He was a young man when he first came here. He spent 13 seasons here. He's back, et cetera. Does he still feel like he's part of that family? Did he feel like he ever strained that familial relationship?
Oh, it was definitely strained. I think we can all agree on that. When he left, it wasn't in the prettiest way. And the way things went down with him and Riley, especially some of it publicly, it was tough. And they both, I think, needed some time apart to be able to have that perspective again, you know, I do think that, you know, that there was a strain, but that it didn't take, just having the time apart, it didn't take like a big conversation for them to rekindle things, really. It was more so, you know, Wade spent a lot of time elsewhere and the organization spent a lot of time without him. And I think they both just gained an appreciation for each other in that time.
But I mean, does it come across like when he talks about, or when Haslip talks about, does it come across as maybe a little superficial? Because I think, you know, when he left, he never, I mean, I know this was a mostly positive piece about his return to Miami, but his departure was, you know, a difficult one. And a lot of it was about money. So kind of, screw family. I wanted to get paid in 2014 or 2015 when he left. Right. And now that's kind of swept under the rug. Did we just not talk about that ugly incident back in 2015? Now everything's hunky-dory.
I mean, to be fair, like, you know, the reason it wasn't in my piece was just because I figured everybody, like, everyone kind of knew about it. Like,
sure, no, I
really get the pass or anything. But, you know, it does feel genuine, I think. Just, like, when I was talking to him, you know, this doesn't have to be, like, it's not like a scientific thing, but when I was talking to him, like the happiest he was talking about being in Miami and being back. And I think his teammates kind of felt the same way too. Just having him back there was nice for some of the guys that were there as rookies. Like for Richardson, for example, was there as a rookie. And
yeah, sure.
He took Richardson under his belt a little bit. So just, you know, having the guy who kind of helped build the whole institution back there, it kind of made it nostalgic for everybody. And there was a lot of good vibes. That was for sure. And I think for them, it seems like the basketball part, at least when I talked to them, was almost secondary. It's like, we can talk about Wade's flaws and his strengths at this point as a basketball player. But, you know, for them largely right after it had happened, it was pretty much like they were just happy to have their guy back.
I feel like that family works things out quote from Udonis Haslem is not exclusive of that, of the fact that Wade left for money, right? Like, you know, families fight for money or because of money all the time, and they work it out later. And it does, I don't know, from afar, because I feel like Wade does genuinely appreciate being back in Miami. I just, that probably could not have happened 2 years ago. Like, he wouldn't have been as happy to be back in Miami maybe if he had just re-signed for like $10 million a year or something back in 2015. But look, he did give up something in a sense. He gave up a potential title run, right? A potential run to the finals again. He talked to you about how much he loves that atmosphere. There was a great anecdote in there how he's never missed a finals since he went to the one in 2006, and the way that, you know, he'll pay his own way to go watch them in person. He loves that competitive atmosphere, but he's clearly not going to get that in Miami probably ever while he's still there. Their rebuilding process is a little bit more prolonged than maybe Wade's career is going to let him play. But did you get the sense from him, with talking with him, that he's content to not get back to the NBA Finals? And this is, you kind of mentioned, it's not really a basketball thing why he's here. It's more of a come back to Miami. That is certainly taking precedent over, or is a bigger priority to him at this point than just making it back and trying to win another ring, right?
Yeah, I mean, because it's, even given Miami's circumstances, because it's hard to get any player to admit on the record that their team is not going to win a championship, I didn't really get him to go that far. But yes, the undertone of it was very much that this is the that he'd rather be in Miami than be in Cleveland trying to win a championship. That was imminently clear.
Thinking about like Spoelstra, you talked to him a lot about Wade's impact and stuff like that. And I don't know how much Miami you've seen since Wade joined, but they've almost come to rely on him a little too much. You know, like there are times when he's like, not just in the waning moments of a close game or anything like that, but they've gone to him a lot more than I would have expected. And he's become like a really dominant part of the team in just a few weeks since, you know, or I guess over a couple of months now. But, you know, in talking with Spoelstra, like, how does he feel about Wade and his return? Like, is it really just like he has that much faith, or does he kind of have to defer a little bit to a guy who is an established superstar of Wade's caliber or something along those lines?
You know, it feels to me like Wade ended up filling a vacuum.
Yes, we talked about that a number of times. He's like, he is now the team's closer because there wasn't anybody willing to assume that role since he left.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I had actually written a piece about Miami's crunch time offense a couple of months before this came out. It was a little while before before Wade was traded back to Miami. Mm-hmm. And at the time, things were going relatively well. It was right after that. It was right after they had beat the Utah Jazz and then beat the Raptors using pretty much the same play, just with
Wayne Ellington.
You know, one more action. Yeah, the Wayne Ellington three. And you know, and I was in Toronto and I was writing about the Heat, and I was kind of trying to press Spo about what his first and second options were on that play, like who he prefers to go to. Mm-hmm. And obviously he didn't really go there, but at the same time, then I reminded him of that when I was talking to him about Wade, and I was like, yo, you're this guy who, like, this is kind of the stuff that you'll do. Like, you're a tactician, and yet you say, hey, I'm okay with like I'll live and die with Wade's, with the ball in Wade's hands, or what, something along the lines of that is what he said. Mm-hmm. And he kind of just concurred. He was like, yeah. And you know, he added that, you know, just sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean it being Wade. Sometimes it's a decoy, and you know, you go elsewhere because everybody expects it to be Wade. But I mean, for the large part, we haven't really seen too much of that. And the other thing is, like, we're losing a lot of games before Wade came. We're losing some close games before he came. So it's kind of odd, right? Like, it's been an up and down crunch time team all season. They didn't really get too much of a chance to see if the method of trying to just run a really good set with five guys who are semi threats will work, because Wade kind of showed up. And you know, it's I don't really have the answer as to like what will work better. I think some combination of two. You don't really necessarily want him dribbling out the clock or anything like that, but
Spoelstra always tends to be kind of secretive. Like, you're not the first person, obviously, to press him on, like, hey, what were you thinking with that play? And he never, it annoys the crap out of me, because he does draw up really nice plays, and he's not really known for it. And I feel like if you were to talk about it a little bit more, he'd get a little bit more light about you know, how good he is and with those out of timeout plays and things like that. And I feel like Brad Stevens gets all the glory there, which I know Heat fans aren't necessarily happy about. But David, this question's for you, and Sarat, if you have an idea, jump in. But who do you know, David, who the one player that is averaging more field goal attempts per 100 possessions more than Dwayne Wade?
Is it Deion Waiters? Is it
only
Deion
one
Waiters?
Player has or it's not
Deion Waiters,
wide
or on the Heat roster?
On the Heat's roster this season, there's only one player who's averaged more field goal attempts per 100 possessions than Dwayne Wade.
For hilarity,
Ellington?
You have Wayne Ellington, David? What did you say, Sarat?
For the sake of hilarity. And you said per 100 possessions, right?
Correct.
Whiteside?
No.
Oh, okay.
Whiteside's up there. Whiteside is like,
I kind of figured. Yeah, like when he does get out there, he's eating them up.
And to your point, David, Deion was at 22.4. Dwayne Wade is at 26.2 field goal attempts per 100 possessions. The only player more. Matt Williams in his 27.4 field goal attempts per 100 possessions. He played three games for a total of 11 minutes with Miami before they let him go. But he did go to UCF. Okay. Go Knights.
Well, I had one quick question. Sorry, I had one quick question. How did Spoelstra pronounce Panache?
Oh, he said it right.
Maybe
I should have added that in the piece. He says, I don't even know how to say it, pronouncing it perfectly, by the way.
I was curious. Yeah, he makes it sound like he had no idea what this word even means. Like, he heard it in conversation, he wanted to sound cool by using it as a
good for Spo. So, you're close to the Raptors, who are going to have a lot of eyes on them when the playoffs start in a few days. We'll talk about what they have to do to get out of the East after this quick break. Hey, everyone. I hope you're subscribed to Locked On NBA. Yes, yes, yes. This is Locked On Heat, and we appreciate you subscribing and listening to this, as always. But you're going to want to add Locked On NBA to your daily podcast playlist. Why? because it's the only daily NBA podcast that's less than 30 minutes long and delivers the most important news, scores, and storylines of the day. It's bite-sized, it's consumable, it's ready to go every day for you. And make sure to listen on Tuesdays, because that's when David and I are hosting. To get the latest episode every day, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcasting app. Until LeBron leaves, I still think the Cavaliers are the odds-on favorites to come out of the East. I want to get to the rest of the conference later on, but let's chat about these Raptors. The Cavs have been, obviously, a thorn in the Raptors' side for years. It's an up year for Toronto. It's a down year for Cleveland. Do they have what it takes to beat the Cavs this year?
I was a lot more confident about this before they had they pulled off all their trades. It's really, really hard to bet against LeBron, and I'm in the position right now where I'm kind of just praying that they somehow still force themselves into the 3 seed, which is obviously where any team wants to be right now. It's the best path to the Eastern Conference Finals, because I don't want the Raptors to avoid Cleveland because they'll get an extra round. Although as a freelancer, that would be very nice, but for their own sake, I would like for them to face LeBron later, because the later it is, the more tired he will be. If the Raptors
has he ever been tired? I can't recall.
He got tired last year in the finals. Hey.
Oh. Got tired in 2014, that's for sure.
But yeah, no. So I'd rather see them later. And I think if the Raptors are to pull it off, it's going to be because LeBron is running on fumes. And I mean, he's trying to play 82 games. He's up. I think he's like pretty much always in the top three in minutes throughout the duration of the season. It's just not a good combination for a guy in his 15th season who has been to multiple finals and is now running everything because they don't have another ball handler really, or another creator. So, you know, he can do it all. That's how he thrives. That's always how he operates best, and it makes his teams very dangerous. But it also, you know, you run the risk of exhausting him. That's happened in the past. I think the Raptors have enough defenders to really give him a hard time between OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, and you know, maybe Norman Powell, but those are three guys that you can kind of just throw on and give him different looks. And depending on the type of game he's having, like, I think anybody who's seen LeBron play, he's kind of one of those weird players where every night he has a different sort of advantage based on, I guess, I don't know, based on who he's being that night. So it's nice that the Raptors have three completely different defenders that are suited to defend different things. I think that'll give him a little bit of an advantage. But
do you think that that's how Toronto's going to defend him, with a multiple set of guys? Because yeah. There's several players over the last few years who've actually made a name of themselves, mm-hmm. younger players in the playoffs by guarding LeBron. You think about Paul George, Kawhi Leonard in the finals, those two seasons with the Spurs. Have you seen, I want to talk about OG Anunoby there, because he seems like physically the best matchup, right? But he is a rookie. Mm-hmm. Is he Toronto's best option to guard LeBron down the stretch towards the end of games?
I think they're going to end up starting with OG because he's in the starting lineup. But I think, and the numbers actually don't bear this out, but just it's also like they haven't had that many looks at each other this season. So I think the eye test is probably a better way to go with this. I think Siakam is the best defender they have to defend LeBron. He is definitely fast enough. He's got the height. I think he's more likely to be able to goad LeBron into jumpers than pretty much anybody else on the roster. And if he becomes wise to it, which I'm sure he quickly will, then I think, you know, he can back Siakam down in the post pretty easily. That's kind of the problem there. Okay. OG has the opposite thing where he's definitely oddly, like, for a rookie, like, he's an animal. He definitely has the strength to guard LeBron down low, but he's a rookie. He's just gonna end up making mistakes, and he's also a guy that I think is a little too confident in his lateral speed sometimes, and he can get blown by because of that. So
yeah, he seems kind of overconfident in almost any aspect of his game, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's generally. I mean, Siakam's definitely a little bit overconfident in his offensive game from time to time, but all that stuff is this is borne itself out. The thing with the Raptors this season is they kind of want all their players to be overconfident and just see if they can stretch their games out. And it's kind of worked, so, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And then for Norm, Norm's kind of just a guy who has, like, he's like their veteran defenders. I don't know if he adds any really extra strength against LeBron because he doesn't really have any physical advantages over him the way the other guys do, but he's like, he's just generally like the most solid guy that's going to probably guard LeBron the most status quo way possible.
Sure. Yeah. It's going to be a group of guys there. It sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for sure. You know what? The Raptors also switch a lot. So, you good know, point. It's going to be any number of those guys.
Well, I feel like I'd be remiss if, you know, we didn't bring up Toronto's past in the playoffs. I mean, I know that it's probably a tiresome topic for you to discuss, but from our listeners' perspective, I feel like that they still consider Toronto to be this team that is likely to wilt in the first or second round and not be able to advance past that. Because of the you know, there has been some evidence that Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan struggle in the playoffs.
I've actually got my call ready for when they lose. I got the sense to the Wizards, so I'm just waiting to hit publish.
So I mean, what do you think about that? You know, that I mean, I don't know if you were how long you've been covering the team. I mean, I know you're based out of Toronto, but do you get a sense that they kind of shrink away from the moment? Is it just a combination of injury or bad matchups or something like that? And how are they going to respond to it this year, in your opinion?
So it's actually my first year covering the Raptors, so I can't speak to how different they are from the other iterations as far as like just locker room vibes or anything like that. But they've made themselves a lot more gimmick proof for the playoffs. First of all, Lowry and DeRozan just have gotten so much more rest this season. Their minutes are way, way down. That's largely because the bench has been so good that they can kind of, you know, they're just a knockout punch, and then you can just ride it out for the rest of the game with whoever, for at least against like some of the worst teams in the league. So it's really given them a breather that they haven't had before. And the Raptors have also become a little bit more progressive about their rest. They really weren't last year. They were really – it used to be a team that really just rode out their guys to squeeze out that extra win. That's just not something they're doing anymore. Ironically, they've broken their franchise record in regular season wins while doing that. They also are just so much more dynamic offensively. I think that's obviously been the biggest story of the year for the Raptors, the way that they've moved the ball around or shooting more threes. They're, you know, just a lot more egalitarian. The ball doesn't just stick in DeMar and Kyle's hands. They run a ton of dribble handoffs with Valanciunas, and they run more. They're better defensively. And I think the defense we'll have to see about, because I have some questions about that. But offensively, they've just made themselves so much tougher to guard, and they have more than one look now because they can go back and be that plotting, isolation-heavy team. I know that everybody in Toronto was freaked out that that's going to happen. But, you know, it used to be DeMar shooting over two guys and getting trapped, but I think this time around the adjustments will probably lead to trying to goad guys like Lowry and DeMar into jumpers, and that's not the best way to run an offense, but it's, if that's going to be the worst case scenario, that's, you know, you can get pretty far in the East just riding two superstars and not riding one superstar and one star and, you know, seeing where it goes.
That's very true, and there's a lot of teams in the East right now that have two superstars. So we want to talk about some of those other teams in the East after this quick break. It's easier than ever to listen to Locked On Heat. You don't even have to use your hands. Now you can stream the show on your smart speaker, such as Amazon Echo or Google Home. It's easy. Here, I'll show you. Alexa, play the Locked On Heat podcast.
Getting the latest episode of Locked On Heat. Here it is from TuneIn.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Now it's that much easier to stay up to date on the latest episodes of Locked On Heat, the only daily Miami Heat podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcasting app. Milwaukee, Miami, and Washington all bunched up out there at the bottom for the seeds 6-8. Sarah, who do you think is the toughest first-round opponent out of that group?
Oh, I think it's Washington. Just because they've never been a great matchup for Toronto. They force both Lowry and, like, Lowry always plays defense, but they force DeRozan to play defense, like, pretty much every possession. Okay. And they're also, like, there's just some bad juju there. They were swept by the Wizards a couple years ago. And, you know, it was one of those off seasons where everything could have kind of changed, but they chose to run it back. But they were just, you know, there's a lot of not so great memories for anybody who is who's hoping that the Raptors don't revert to their former selves. They also, you know, they have so many more looks they can throw at you, especially with Satoransky now. They're not the most stable team in the league, but they also always overperform in the playoffs. They pretty much, anytime they've gone deep in the playoffs, they've done it by being one of the worst seeds. They don't tend to have home court advantage. Okay. They outperform what you expect them to be. They've got toughness in the playoffs. Now they've got a really good deal of playoff experience as well. John Wall is just a guy who can pretty much put anybody on skates. The emergence of Bradley Beal. You had Satoransky in there and Porter. And then Morris, like,
it's that backcourt, really.
The wings, too. They're just like, they have wings that can shoot and play defense, and they're very long. And that's going to give a guy like DeMar problems. There's just nowhere to hide, really. Like, they can kind of just run a spread pick and roll and kill you over and over again.
Is that you mentioned there that playing the Wizards makes DeRozan. It forces him to play defense. Is that obviously that's because, you know, Lowry usually takes the more threatening offensive player on the opposing backcourt, and you can't really do that. You have Wall and Beal against Washington, so DeRozan's got to defend one of those guys. Is that sort of if Toronto's defense has a kryptonite? Is that it? Is that like the dual backcourt of guys like Wall and Beal?
Happening, and it's something that happens a lot against the Wizards, is they'll just put, or they'll try to get a switch to get DeMar on one of their stronger offensive players, and they'll just put him through pick and rolls with Jonas Valanciunas, and that's just like, that's layups for Gortat every single time. I think maybe some of that will correct itself because Jonas has made some strides defensively, but for any team that kind of has that ability to make you commit in the mid-range, like, it's so awful for their pick-and-roll defense. I think that's why you kind of saw them get cut up by the Cavs. They're a little bit more deliberate, whereas, for example, a team like Houston, they just don't even look at the mid-range, so they were able to kind of hide by dropping their guys back. But anybody who can just kind of hang out there and force a commitment, and that's something that Wall and Beal do very, very well, is going to be able to cut up that pick and roll defense. And, you know, maybe that's going to mean that Jonas is not that playable in a series like that. Obviously, like, the Raptors are actually very similar to the Heat in that you have to throw up a lot of different lineups, and it's kind of a Swiss Army knife situation, but there's also times where you wish that, like, you kind of just fuse two players together and have that be your guy.
Speaking of that matchup with Miami, I mean, if Miami should drop to the eighth seed, which is certainly a possibility at this point, you know, how do you perceive that potential matchup going down? I mean, I heard from some Toronto beat reporters that they were concerned about Miami because they always play tough, et cetera. And you know, there's the experience factor there with Dwayne Wade back on the roster. So do you feel like they would match up fairly evenly with Toronto, or because of their lack of a superstar there, that they'd eventually get beat down pretty easily by this Raptors team?
Yeah, I think honestly, they would, like, their ceiling would have to be six games in that series, I think.
Yeah.
I just don't really see Miami's way of beating Toronto. Like, the way that Miami beats a lot of other teams is they can match up with them and kind of put them into two impossible situations.
Right.
And Toronto can match up with them. Like I just said, they're very similar. Like, you want to go small, you want to go small where you're actually kind of big with Bam. Like, we have Siakam. Like, there's a lot of different ways that Toronto can counter what Miami does. And once, if you even out those things, and Toronto has the two best players in the series.
Yeah.
Good point.
So, I mean, Spo's a better coach. So, you know, maybe, and there's also randomness going to have to playoffs. Sometimes the Raptors just don't hit their shots.
Yeah.
It's also a very Miami thing, so I don't know. Like, again, the similarities are you know, it's going to make for an interesting series, I think. But that's the team I'd much rather see Toronto play than Milwaukee, where their best player is just leaps and bounds better, and they don't really they have an execution deficit versus a talent deficit, and I think talent wins out in the playoffs, whereas Miami executes very well, and that's why they play well.
Yeah, it hurts that Miami doesn't have Dion Waiters, because then they would have a legitimate superstar in the series, but.
It's true. Although if they had Dion Waiters, then this whole Wade thing would probably be going very, very differently. Gosh.
Well, I mean, Wade would just have to accept his role as the second best shooting guard in Heat history. I mean, that's it.
That's true. As I wrote, Wade has a gift of self-honesty, and I think he'd be able to look himself in the mirror and say, you know what, Dion Waiters.
It's just like when he did it with LeBron. It would be the same thing.
I've got to ask, because we didn't bring it up in that first section, mm-hmm. segment, but do you get a sense that Wade is going to come back to Miami? Do you feel like he's kind of done or might be looking to retire after this year?
I don't think he knows.
Mm. Okay.
He's going to wait it out and see. If he plays well in the playoffs, I think then it kind of does. But I think if he doesn't, it just doesn't really make sense for him to stay.
All right, final question here before we let you go. If Toronto and Cleveland aren't the ones to get out of the East, who do you think would be?
Philly.
Yeah,
they're my dark horse.
I'm with you. I think that's
they've
true.
They've got it all, and they're playing so well. They're peaking at the exact right moment.
Yeah, except for Embiid like breaking his face, but he'll be fine.
Oh, but yeah, it was like a random, not like, you know, lower body type of injury with Embiid. It was just unfortunate. It was really unfortunate for Markelle Fultz, actually. That was unfortunate for him.
I'm sure his elbow isn't feeling that great.
No, it was his shoulder, wasn't it? Didn't he lean his shoulder?
Yeah. Or his shoulder.
I remember watching the play again. It was just a bad timing. Like the pass went a little low and fell out of Embiid's hands, and he dropped to go pick it up and then gets a Markelle shoulder right in his face. That was just not particularly good. I don't know about Philly, you guys. I, to be honest with you, I just don't see it. I mean,
you hated the Sixers. I tend season, to think you've that hated them. You hate them.
Damn right. And I always will too. Screw the process.
They'd have the best players in a lot of series.
Yeah, I also what I hate about them is
really good defense. Yes. They're very long. They can shoot.
I hate that they have this kind of duplication of skills too, where they have JJ Redick in the starting lineup, then they take him out and bring in Bellinelli. They got Šarić in there, and then they bring in Ilyasova. It's like, come on, you know, it's got they have like a whole second wing and platoon.
You have Ilyasova as mini Šarić. I've got Šarić as mini Simmons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what
Ben
I was
Simmons
thinking.
Comes out and
oh, sorry. All right.
He's the X factor, because now that he's shooting, they're filled with so much more playmaking, and like it makes them so much more dynamic when Šarić is on the floor with Simmons.
And Ben Simmons is not a real rookie, so he's got a little bit more experience.
Did you guys see the sweatshirt that Donovan Mitchell wore to the
I saw a tweet about it, but I didn't see the exact shirt.
A hoodie that has the definition of rookie on it. And it says, an athlete playing his or her first season as a member of a professional sport.
What color is the hoodie?
It's just black and white.
Perfect. Like, I love it. Wow. Donovan Mitchell, he's like, by the rules, he shouldn't win Rookie of the Year. It should be Ben Simmons. Mm-hmm. But damn it, I really want Donovan Mitchell to win it, because I hate the rule that Ben Simmons – I hate that rule. He's not a rookie. I don't know how many times I have to talk about this, but it just fires me up.
Yeah. I feel you. I just feel like such a party pooper when I think about that. Because it is – I think it's one of those things where I understand the argument, but I also think that I've increasingly only seen the argument now that Simmons has kind of separated himself from Mitchell. Like, let's say from the beginning of the season, everybody who was caping for Mitchell was saying that. I'd have a little bit more respect for that argument. But now that it's like Simmons is playing so well and they're – this argument comes out. And I actually happen to kind of agree with that, especially given what Simmons is so good at. Like, he sees the game faster than everybody else. He has poise. It's all slowed down for him. You know, he's obviously very strong and athletic. And that is obviously that some of that is natural, but he also, you know, spent a season with the full out NBA team. All that stuff that he has, it's kind of separating himself from all the other rookies is stuff that you kind of gain from being on an NBA team.
Exactly. And I would actually be more okay with Ben Simmons getting on one of the three all NBA teams. I'd be more okay with that than him winning Rookie of the Year. And he's going to win Rookie of the Year.
I also think that even when you do factor in for all that stuff, he's just so good. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I was doing like top 10 players in the league, and I think it was because we were kind of trying to figure out like where we rank Kyrie, and I was like, where do I put Ben Simmons? Like, honestly, like is Ben Simmons better than Kyrie Irving? I think he might be.
I have Kyrie Irving at 10, right behind Damian Lillard, but Ben Simmons is top 20. I want to see the jump shot in the playoffs. I want to see how much that matters.
Fair enough. Yeah.
All right, let's wrap this up. Where can people find you, Surat?
I'm on Twitter at Damian Trillard. I do a weekly column at SB Nation called The Tip-Off. This week, I believe I will be writing something about the Indiana Pacers. We're a very, very interesting team to think about. They're just kind of there, and I don't know. Nobody's decided how they feel about them this season. It's probably because they're the Indiana Pacers.
I've been trying to figure it out, yeah.
So, yeah, that's a – and then, you know, once the playoffs start, just Raptor stuff, probably mostly at SB Nation.
Good conversation. A lot to look forward to. This last night of the regular season is going to be nuts. And the playoffs, I think, are going to be a lot of fun. But that's all we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow. You can send mailbag questions and ask about advertising by sending an email to lockedonheat@gmail.com. Tweet your questions or comments for our recaps using the hashtag AskLOHeat. Support the show by visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/lockedonheat. Music is courtesy of Mojave Wild. We'll catch you next time.